This is a segment from The Annex, an academic sociology-themed podcast. For more, visit us on the web at theannexpodcast.com. And now we turn to Conrad Hackett, Associate Director of Research and Senior Demographer at the Pew Research Center. Conrad recently authored The Changing Global Religious Landscape, a study that chronicled long-term changes in the global population across religions. We're very happy to have him here. Thank you for joining us, Conrad.
It's great to be with you guys.
So tell us about your report, The Changing Global Religious Landscape. What did you find?
We spent several years looking at religion in every country of the world. And after figuring out how large religious populations are, and incidentally, the Christian population is about 31% of the world's population. The Muslim population is 24% of the world. People with no religion are about 16% of the world, and so on. We then looked at age distributions, fertility rates, patterns of religious change, people who grew up in one religion and identify with another. And assuming that things would continue as they have as far as switching patterns, the fertility patterns would go at the country level the way the UN expects while maintaining religious differences, we put projections out there about how religious numbers will change. And the story that got the most attention in media around the world is that the Muslim population globally is expected to grow twice as fast as the world's overall population, with Christians roughly keeping pace. So Christian shares are going down in Europe and in North America, but in Africa, the population is growing tremendously, and most people in Africa identify as either Christian or Muslim, and so that's a big driver of overall population change.
You said if things keep going like this, so this, I assume this is some assumption that in some way is more or less like assuming a Markovian process and you're just taking the transition matrix. How stable is that transition matrix? Do we have the same transition matrix now that we had in the 50s?
Well, the big thing that drives these numbers are fertility patterns. So in a country like Nigeria, right now, let's say that women are having five kids and Muslim women are having seven kids and Christian women are having five kids. The United Nations has a projection for how the rate at which fertility is going to decline in the country overall. And we assume that eventually over 100 years, the difference between Muslims and Christians will entirely converge. But meanwhile, as country level fertility declines, there's still a significant difference between Muslims and Christians. And so we play out the consequences of that. But fertility patterns could diminish slower than the UN expects. And in a lot of African countries, that's been the case, that fertility rates have actually stayed higher longer than demographers anticipated. But it's also possible that there could be a rapid change, as there was in Iran not so long ago.
I see. So the really big assumption you have to make is how long it'll take African Muslims and African Christians to undergo the second demographic transition.
That's a big factor, yes.
What were the big reactions from the findings? I mean, it got great play, right? It was in the Times. What did people, what were the big takeaways or reactions that people had?
I think when it comes to this kind of data, there really hasn't been a lot of work because it's so much effort to put all the information together and to make sense of it, to do it carefully and methodically. So I think there was just a lot of interest in the story that was told. And I talked about the global pattern, but we also put out projections for each country. So in countries around the world, there were stories that would focus on the projection for that particular a part of the world and what change was anticipated there. The other story that we talked about in the report is change for people who have no religious identity, atheists, agnostics, or people who are just kind of indifferent to religion. And clearly in the United States and in Europe, Australia, New Zealand, the share of people who currently don't identify with religion has been increasing. But by our count, the largest number of people who don't identify with a particular religion is in China, followed by Japan, and then the United States. And China and Japan have an aging population and low fertility. And in the U.S. and in other Western nations, you also have low fertility among people who identify with no religion, although in the West, it's a younger population. But the net effect is that even though there's growth, especially in Western countries, through people defecting from religion to having no religion, the overall population is growing faster in Africa, in many Asian countries. And so if current rates of switching continue, then we project that the numbers of people with no religion are going to be pretty flat as a count and actually decrease as a share of the world's population, going from 16% now to about 13%. Mm-hmm. At mid-century.
So I got two questions on the nuns. First, how closely associated...
The no religions, not their...
Not religious sisters, those who have no religious preference. Yeah. So on N-O-N-E nuns, first, how closely associated is this with atheism? Because my understanding is that there's a huge number of people who believe in God, perhaps in some vague sense, but they're not religious.
Yes, right. So so atheists would be a significant subset of the nun or unaffiliated population. And when our report came out, the great paragon of British journalism, the Daily Mail, had this kind of fun headline where they said, you may be surprised to learn that the third largest religious population is atheists. And we said, well, that's not quite right. This category includes atheists, but it's much broader. So they corrected it. And they said, you may be surprised to learn the third largest religious group is the religiously unafflicted. and so that was kind of a funny play on our unaffiliated label. But it's a common confusion. So yeah, we're not saying atheists are the third largest group, although they're part of this category.
But what percentage of religious nuns are atheists?
I can't give you a number off the top of my head. We don't necessarily have that for every country. And in some countries like China, it's actually a complicated thing to measure because the word that's often translated in China for atheist is actually a Communist Party member. So it's a little tricky to get a solid grip on.
Yeah, kind of like how in ancient Greece and Rome, atheist meant someone who declined to worship the state gods, even if they did so because they were a Christian. My second question on the nuns, you talked about how there's a huge number of nuns in China, and you know, but there's also a large number of religious people in China, and this is an active area of state policy in China. So you know, we see outright suppression of the Muslim minority in the West, where they're basically taking large numbers of the Uyghur people and putting them into re-education camps that, you know, you read the description, they sound like something straight out of the Cultural Revolution. And they're actively trying to get them to embrace Communist Party ideology when they're not. And then those people who aren't in re-education camps, they're, you know, forcing them to keep their restaurants open during Ramadan, serve pork, that sort of thing. And then among Christians, you have what, if we were in the Middle Ages, we would call an investiture crisis, where, you know, for a long time, there were two Catholic churches in China. There was an underground church that was in communion with the Archbishop of Hong Kong, and through him with the Pope. And then there was the Patriotic Catholic Association that was basically run by the Communist Party. And Pope Francis has just agreed to basically sign on with the party-run church, rather than the underground church. And then my understanding is you also see similar issues with Protestants, where, you know, occasionally you'll see some Protestant church get bulldozed or something like that. So this seems to be a case where you have a huge country where, you know, a plurality, probably even a majority of the people are sincerely nuns, but there's also a substantial minority of religious Christians or religious Muslims, and the state is actively pushing people away from that. So how much of this do you think will be shaped by policy? Or to put in another counterfactual, how different do you think the trends would be if China had a First Amendment?
Well, I can't really comment on what effect this restrictive policy is having on the Chinese numbers. But even before the most recent round of religious restrictions have been imposed, there was a lot of debate about what's going on with numbers in China. So Rodney Stark at Baylor University and Fengang Yang at Purdue have both published recently claims that within the span of a few decades, the share of people who identify as Christian in China could quickly become the majority, even the overwhelming majority of the Chinese population. And that's a pretty bold claim, because although there are many stories written about the growth of Christianity in particular cities or provinces of China, the fact is that all the survey data that's come out in the last 20 years or so consistently shows that about 3% of people in any given survey identify as Christian. That's no doubt an undercount, because people who are part of the party or who belong to house churches, unregistered churches, may not want to reveal their identity in a survey. So we estimated maybe 5% of the country is Christian. But actually, again, before the most recent crackdowns, that number has been very stable. So it's possible that numbers are growing and it's just not detected in surveys. But it's, I think one has to be cautious when you come across these claims that the Christian population is growing so fast that most people in China will soon be Christian. Muslims are a small minority in China. As you mentioned, the Uyghurs and other ethnic groups are associated with Islam. Interestingly, because China is such a big country, even though Muslims are a tiny minority, there are about as many Muslims in China as are in Saudi Arabia.
Wow. You said that India was going to be the largest Muslim community by 2050, surpassing Indonesia.
Yes, that's right. So again, you have a huge country. Soon India is going to have more people than China has. And even though Muslims are a minority in India, India will soon be home to the largest Muslim population in the world. Right now, India and Pakistan and Indonesia all have similar numbers of Muslims, and soon we expect India is going to pull ahead.
So I have a question. So what does this all mean, right, for the future, right? So it seems to me that regardless of, you know, sort of how the numbers shake out like 50 years from now, let's say, in terms of which religious group constitutes, you know, the most populous on earth, I guess I'm giving you the so what question, right? Why does it matter? And how will it matter?
In Europe, there's sort of a microcosm of a divide that's happening globally. We put out a report just a few months ago about the growing Muslim population in Europe. And so Europe's a region where the mm-hmm. total population is actually in decline. And if it's going to grow at all, it's going to be through migration. And a lot of the people who are migrating to Europe are Muslim, and they're younger, and they're having more children, and they're probably more devout than non-Muslims in Europe. And so that speaks to the fact that generally, globally, the religious population is demographically different from the secularizing West. You could think about there being a secularizing West and a rapidly growing rest of the world.
No, so what I was going to say, so one of the things that I like, I'm speculating here, but I'm speculating on this, is that I think one of the reasons why this story generated so much interest globally isn't not just that people are like, this is fascinating, because it is, but I think also people are afraid. And, you know, I think just like with the number that we had projected here in the United States, that in 2050, you know, America is going to be a minority majority country and the Latino population is going to explode. I think that we have actually seen as a consequence of that, I don't know if it's a direct consequence, but I think we've seen as a consequence of that, lots of policies that have been put in place in this country to actually slow that growth and actually help to ensure that if this is going to become a reality, we're going to push that back 100 years. And so it seems to me that we might be preparing to see the same kind of response in Europe to ensure, right?
If I can just endorse Conrad's study, though, because Conrad's study, I see as pushing back against that, because there are a lot of sort of virulent narratives going around about Europe becoming like completely Muslim or overwhelmingly Muslim in 30 years. There's a lot of alarmism that is circulating. that makes just really improbable demographic estimates. But because they sound mathematical and convincing and they're produced in sleek videos, you'll have people clicking on them in Facebook and you'll have people reacting to them as if they feel like they're being invaded. And a study like Conrad's, which gives you sensible estimates, pushes back against that type of alarmism. Sometimes like just the, just the basic numbers that can be used by tons of
people. Oh yeah, no, I mean, I'm not endorsing the study. I think it's a great study. Right. I'm actually like pondering here, right? I mean, there are lots of great studies out there that are just like, look, here are the numbers, right? That then cause people to like act in very reactionary ways, right? That you're just like, whoa, 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 right? This was just a number.
So I wanted to follow up on something Conrad said earlier about, you know, these younger global South, or at least global South origin populations being more religiously devout. You know, we talked about the, you know, the nuns, which are kind of an extreme case of, you know, lapsing. But, you know, even among people who are, you know, active religious practitioners, you see variations in devotion, conservativeness, all those sorts of things. Did you guys measure not just whether somebody's, you know, Catholic, Protestant, Muslim or whatever, but within whether they're Salafist or, you know, what, or whether they're, you know, mainline Protestant or Pentecostal or something like that? Because I'm thinking, like, you mentioned Indonesia a little earlier, and famously Southeast Asian Islam was very, I don't know what you want to call it. People always say moderate, although that's not necessarily the right word. But there's been a lot of Saudi missionary activity there that's encouraged more of a Saudi model for Southeast Asian Islam. And then likewise within Christianity, you know, you see big differences in that African Christianity is generally more conservative than European and to a lesser extent North American Christianity. And so, for instance, with all the troubles that the Catholic Church has been experiencing, conservatives in the Catholic Church always have this hope that Cardinal Serra from Guinea will achieve more power. So did you guys measure that? Like, will we see compositional shifts? Was that something you were able to measure and project? Levels of devotion, all that sort of thing?
Well, I guess there are two aspects of your question that I hear. One is, do we have subgroups in Christianity or Islam or the unaffiliated? And no, although it would certainly be interesting to have estimates for the size of these subgroups, we found it ambitious enough just to get the big picture for 8 religious groups in every country of the world and how they're changing. But separately and more recently, mm-hmm. analyzing Pew Research Center surveys that we've done in more than 100 countries around the world, we just put out a report on the age gap in religion around the world, which both chronicled the fact that in many countries, the older generation, people over 40, are more devout on measures of attendance, prayer, salience, and affiliation than the young. But we also have maps and tables showing geographically these divides. And so you see clearly that in Africa, broadly speaking, in many Asian countries, there are higher levels of devotion, but we don't get into the kind of relationship between the composition of those countries and the higher devotion.
Conrad, have you ever, have you guys gotten any pushback in terms of, you know, the chicken or the mm-hmm. egg question? Like, is it that religiosity, you know, leads to birth rates, or is it that, you know, childless people tend not to adopt religion? Like that children are a vehicle by which religion is sort of promoted among families or households.
I'm sure our reciprocal relationships. And then there's also external factors. Education is a big factor that drives the number of children one will have. The late Hans Rosling had a TED talk where he said that basically all you need to know is education, religion doesn't matter. But I think that was a little bit cruder analysis than I would make. I would say after education, religion is an influence on the number of children a woman has, and being part of a religious community does seem to reinforce high fertility. So even in the U.S., if you look at women who are active in congregations, those who are more active If they don't have kids yet, they have higher levels of ideal fertility, and they're more likely to have that third child as opposed to stopping at one or two than similarly educated women who aren't active in congregations.
I have one more question from me. Through this experience, what are the big methodological lessons that you took from like going across borders, dealing with this type of multinational data? What were the big lessons you walked away with? Were there any points that you guys struggle with, like tough to solve problems that you figured out, or?
Yeah, you know, we discovered all kinds of things that I had no idea about. For example, we are looking at the religious composition of people of all ages. And of course, young children don't choose a religion, although children basically tend to adopt as adults the religion of their parents. But when we look at census data from Brazil, for example, we see that children who are newborn, 0 or 1 year old, tend not to have a religion identified by their parents on a census form. But when they get to age 5 or 10, the parent says, oh yeah, my kid's Catholic or Protestant or what have you. And so if we had just taken that information that children at the very youngest ages all had no religion, then we would project greater growth in Brazil of people with no religion than is probably realistic. So we ended up taking the religious composition of people who are 5 to 9, kids 5 to 9, and assigning that same composition to the 0 to 4 age population to sort of correct for this measurement problem in the data. And there are lots of examples of that kind of thing where we had to try to figure out what's the most faithful way to massage the data a little bit to conform to what we believe to be real in the world. Similarly, there were often cases where in a country like Sri Lanka, a given census hadn't been conducted in a conflict area. So we took data from the prior census for that region and used it because the conflict incidentally was related to religious conflict. So just omitting that would have been problematic. So Right. So yeah, so we had to be pretty thoughtful about these kinds of things. We try to document as much of it as we can in our methodology. And I would say one of the strengths of our work is that we do generally have a complete source list in our reports and a pretty significant methodology. One of the sources you could turn to for information about religious composition is the CIA World Factbook. But that has historically not been very transparent about the sources they used and the methods by which they came up with the numbers that they publish.
Yeah, so that's surprising to me that you had that issue with kids not having a religion in Brazil, because Brazil's mostly Catholic, and you'd expect cultures with infant baptism, you know, and or ethno-religious identification to assign religion to children. Like, you know, it makes sense to me if you told me that a Protestant country, you know, people didn't assign religion.
Yeah,
to children,
and I may be overstating it a little bit. It's not that no children had a religion assigned, but it was a much larger share than we expect. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, sure.
Well, I'm not doubting you at all. I'm just saying it's surprising, you know. So I know we're told not to ask you controversial questions, but I hope you can answer this and your publicist won't beat you over the head with it. But which religion's right? Does Pew have an official position on that?
We definitely don't have an official position on that.
Well, you should get to that, because that could be valuable information.
But what's funny along those lines, though, is we do put out estimates of number of Christians or Muslims in the world. And one of the common things people push back on is they'll say, well, those aren't real Christians. You know, if you had some kind of litmus test for true Christianity, there would be a much more select number. But our methodology is basically just to take people at their word. And so those are the numbers we come up with. But we don't have a litmus test or any kind of test of our own for what's true.
For more, visit us on the web, theannexpodcast.com.